So most of my time when I was growing up in Wheaton, Maryland, my mother was an agoraphobic, which meant basically that she never left the house. So my friends had never seen her, and they asked me, you know, Norman, how come we've never seen your mom? And I told them that my mother had died. Okay, not so smart, especially because she found out that I was telling my friends this. My friend Robert called the house, and my mother answered. And she said, hello, this is Norman's dead mother, right? Which is all to say that, you know, we had a sense of humor about things. We were an odd family, but more like the Addams family than the Manson family. You know, humor gets you through a lot. But I actually want to talk about some things that maybe humor doesn't always work for. I want to talk about my younger brother, Sean, who was a hemophiliac, and he died when he was 2 years old. I was 4, and my older brother, Henry, was 6. I don't have a lot of memories of Sean, but they're all happy memories. I didn't live in the world that my parents lived in, this world of fear that Sean would cut himself and bleed and not be able to stop, or that maybe he'd bruise himself and there'd be internal bleeding they might not even know about that might turn out to be fatal. When my father went off to the hospital to give his own blood and transfusions so my brother could stay alive, you know, I didn't really even register that that was what was going on. I just have good memories. And here's my memory, the one that stands out most in my mind, which is standing with my brother outside Sean's crib, which was different from other people's cribs because the other babies' cribs, I guess, because the bars were covered with towels to make it soft. And the whole rim all around the top was foam padded so that he couldn't hurt himself. And my brother came up with this game where we'd line up these plastic bowling pins on the edge of the crib. All 10 of them, they were multicolored. They were really light and really hard to balance because you're balancing on the squishy foam. We'd line them up, and Sean would watch, and he would wait until we were done. And when they were all lined up, then he'd get this little look on his face, and he'd sweep his little fist across and just knock all the pins over and just laugh and laugh. That's what I remember about my younger brother, the bowling pins and the laughing. Like I said, I didn't remember my father's visit to the hospital, and I didn't remember either the night they came back from the hospital, my parents, without him. Now, I know on the way back, my parents had to have been thinking, you know, how are we going to tell Norman and Henry about what happened? What are we going to do? And they had come up with a really comforting speech about, you know, how Sean was an innocent child, how he didn't suffer, how he was in heaven now with God, and we weren't going to die, and everything was going to be fine. The family would be different, but we'd adjust and we'd move on. I'm sure they had a nice comforting speech like that. You know, you have to, because if you get that wrong and you're a parent, you know, you could screw your kids up for the rest of their lives, right? But I don't remember what they said. Just for me, just the bowling pins and the laughter. But I do remember some of the after effects of this, particularly on my mom. There was the agoraphobia, which didn't start right away, but happened kind of gradually. That first she just didn't want to talk to family members or friends about Sean. It was too new. And then she stopped going out to play bridge with her neighbor friends. She stopped going out to visit relatives. She stopped going to the store. And not only did she stay in the house, but she pretty much focused on one room in the house, which was the living room. And she focused on one part of the room, which was the sofa. So she stayed on the sofa almost all the time and watched television, right? She had the remote, but if we kids were walking through and she needed to change the channel, you know, she'd ask us to change it for her. So, you know, we might get her stuff from the kitchen or whatever. But it's even to this day, when I think back on her, I can't imagine her in motion. Right? That I think when the family moved from Wheaton to Damascus, I imagine them just the movers coming in, picking her up on the couch, moving that right in the back of the van, and then they finally drove her in the dark, right? So she's on the couch. The other thing she did was she didn't want people looking in. So she closed the shades, even in the day. So our living room was always dark, right? And around the couch, she kept stacks of newspapers, almost towers. Newspapers, magazines, junk mail, right? Because I think kind of agoraphobia and hoarding behaviors can kind of go together. Great, like peanut butter and chocolate, you know? But so that was kind of one of the effects of Sean's passing. And the other one was that they became very overprotective of us kids, right? One of the things I always remember was if there was just like 1/10 of a percent chance of rain from the weatherman. Then we had these huge rubber boots that my brother and I had to wear. It's like they almost went all the way up our legs in these huge metal buckles, and I started like clomping into school. And I ran into a high school friend like 20 years later, and he's like, "You're the kid with the boots." And I'm like, "Yeah, thanks. Thanks for reminding me," right? So there was that. And they also told these cautionary tales. You know, and I think everybody's parents do those, you know, like, don't, you know, look both ways we're crossing the street, don't put your fingers in the electrical socket, things like that. But I think my parents got a little more into those stories. Like my father would tell me, not just look both ways before crossing the street, but he'd tell me about a kid who didn't and how far he bounced and what bones broke, you know, where the blood stains are, right? And my mother, one of her stories, the one that I always remember, she told my brother and I about dope fiends that were living in the woods behind our house, right? So she calls us into the living room, and the shades are down, it's dark. The TV's on, but the sound's down, so it's like flickering like a campfire. You know, we're hearing a ghost story. And my mother says, "The police found needles in the park." You know, and I'm terrified of needles like any normal kid would be, right? So I always remember stuff like that, like these sort of horrible stories, right? But I think that's still kind of one of the ways of dealing with some of the trauma in our lives, you know, that these things stay with you, but, you know, they're part of what you are, they stay with you, and they're kind of who I am today. I teach, I write horror, and people always say, why? They always say to horror writers, why do you write horror? You know, that stuff is so upsetting. Isn't life upsetting enough? And I think there are a couple ways of dealing with horror or with trauma in your past. One would be to ignore it. Another would be to let it haunt you, which I think is what happened with my mother, that the agoraphobia kind of made it sort of run her life. You could have a sense of humor about it, which works sometimes. Or you could turn it into a story. You could own it by writing about it or talking about it, like I'm doing now. And my first book, Invisible Fences, is, surprise, about a narrator who has a mother who's agoraphobic, who loses a younger sibling at a young age. And it's about parents who tell really scary stories to their children, and the children don't get over the stories, right? And for me, it's kind of a tribute to my mom, who I always remember, right? To my brother, both my brothers, and to my dad, too, who also got me interested in horror. So, thank you.
I find horror to be really, I can't watch it, especially as I've gotten older. But it's always interesting to me to talk to people who continue to propagate it and find out why. It's similar. I once had someone watch The Exorcist with me, which I find to be the most terrifying thing that's ever been created. But this person was an intellectual. And so they were telling me how it was all basically a diatribe about adolescence in the 70s and the lack of control that parents had during that time. And I felt a lot of comfort in that. So that's what I want someone to really, this is your new task, Norman, where are you? Is to focus on the psychological reasons for horror, which I'm sure actually someone has already done, so never mind. But Maura Malone Taylor used to be very cool, and it's still cool, but we're all a little bit older now, so... Anyway, please welcome Maura.